Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
Today's conversation was already announced on social media as Talking Anarchy and Serious Privacying. And that should be no surprise, since two of our guests are prolific social media users, sharing their views on privacy developments as much as talking about clothes, shoes, women's rights, politics, and a whole range of other topics. But most importantly, they show that even in difficult times, it is possible to laugh and have fun. Add to that two of TrustArc's inspiring women, and you can be ensured that you are about to listen to a lighthearted but content-rich episode of Serious Privacy. But with this much data protection, privacy, and privacy engineering power around our virtual table, it is indeed bound to be an episode where discussions will run deep and wide. How mature are data protection, cybersecurity, and privacy engineering as sectors, and where are they going next? Let's ask that to today's guest, Uber CPO and self-named frustrated comedian Ruby Zeffo, godmother of privacy engineering Michelle Dennehy, and TrustArc's general counsel Hilary Wandel. My name is Paul Breitbarth.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. I'm absolutely delighted to have Hilary, Michelle, and Ruby on our show today, because these three ladies are just the names to know in privacy when it comes to it. And I have an unexpected question.
Let's hear it.
If you could have a superpower just for today, what would that superpower be?
I'll start. A billion, billion, billion times my presidential vote.
Bring it, Ruby.
Love it. Michelle, what about you?
Oh, I was hoping Hillary was going to jump in there.
Yeah,
jump in there with your superpower, girl.
So my superpower would be to bring us all together in the same room somehow, some amazing way, because I'm really tired of not seeing anybody in person.
I love that power. See, she's so much nicer than me. I was going to say something like I wanted her outfit and her hair, but let's see.
Think bigger.
I know. I know. We've got like politics sorted out. We've got like transportation done. I'm just going to be a dork right now. I want people to understand the innate value of data. I think that we would inherently change the way that we interact with each other in our world, and particularly what we're talking about in privacy, if we understood the inherent value of having clear, honest, high integrity, and high ethics information. That sounds super dorky, but wouldn't it make our lives a lot easier?
That sounds super professional.
I know, it's shocking coming from me, but it actually is a sincere wish.
Paul, what about you?
Right now, I would probably have the power to force mouth masks on everybody, so that people are continuing to protect themselves. Well, a muzzle would be nice for some people, at least.
I'm not going to ask them for any more details of that part. I have to admit, my superpower I've always wanted, and it will always be the one I want, is the ability to teleport.
Yeah.
I love being other places. And with Hillary, I would love to see people in person, but I can't stand traveling. And that was long before COVID happened. I just don't actually like the process of traveling. But being other places, yes. So wonderful. With that, Paul, let's jump into the first question. Take us away.
Absolutely.
Because this is going to be an amazing conversation. It's just, we have no idea where it's going.
True, but that's more often the case for this podcast, but today maybe even more so. Just to start, because I gave a bit of an introduction, but Ruby and Michelle, could you maybe tell us a bit more about how you ended up in the places where you are today? Maybe Ruby first. How did you end up as CPO of Uber?
Oh, that place. I thought you meant my dining room table and never going outside.
Yeah, that was some animal in China, I guess.
I have an entire setup on my dining room table and I never leave it. It's, and I'm in a rolly chair. Like, I don't even have to stand up most of the time. I just roll around the hardwood floor. That's a small, very tiny form of teleporting without even getting up. Yeah, so I was drop kicked into privacy at my last employer, where we at the time, as I was at Intel Corporation, and Intel often had different views of where its future was going. And at that time had a lot of consumer-based businesses. It had purchased McAfee. It had a wearable with a really strong heart sensor. It was building a set-top box for your living room with a camera recording everybody's media preferences. That's before all the streaming media we have now. It was sort of an idea before its time, and we didn't have the relationships to complete it. But, you know, there was a lot going on where we realized we had to pivot based on the roadmap and what would be launching, you know, our view of privacy. And we had a really small privacy team in the policy group. So literally my boss said, we're actually a little late, but you need to go build a global team and you need to do it yesterday. And it needs to be a really strong team, you know, ready to move. And but while you're at it, pick up IT. I don't really know what's going on with the legal support of IT, but there is that cybersecurity thing. And so I picked it all up at once, which was something.
Yeah.
And so it was learning while doing and, you know, working around the clock for the better part of a year till I felt like my feet were firmly underneath me, going to every conference, you know, networking, local groups, you know, everything I could think of to learn and read and do. And that's how that happened. And I ended up at Uber because, you know, they grew up and wanted to really change their brand and image and become a trusted data steward. And they needed somebody with a good reputation who could come in and really help the company with its, you know, goals to be a much more trusted brand, trusted company, customer focused. And that's what it is. And why they, you know, my boss, Tony West, specifically handpicked his entire staff, which, by the way, is a very diverse staff. I've never worked with so many senior women in my entire career. And so I give him props for showing that that can be done. But that's how that happened. And, you know, they just made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And it was a chance to build something from scratch again. Mm-hmm. And I had the freedom to do it the way I wanted. And so there was an element of trust there that he would, you know, hold up his end of the bargain because it was kind of a black box to me. And you know how people can pull a bait and switch. But of course, he did not do that. He is a very reputable man himself. And that was part of the reason I went too. The people who are there before you can really show you where the intentions of a company is, are going to go. And so I felt pretty confident that they meant business in hiring me, and they did.
Wonderful. Michelle, how about you?
So I was dropkicked earlier than Ruby, but ironically tied to Ruby. So before she became a leader in the privacy sphere, Ruby was a leader in the trademark brand marketing, all sorts of commercial IP, intellectual property law. And I was a patent litigator who was hired by Ruby's FO into Sun Microsystems as a trademark lawyer. And I really was not a trademark lawyer at all. I was a patent litigator. And so as I was sort of ramping up on the trademark side of things, there was this skinny little folder that I still have, actually. It was like 2 pages. And it was an assignment from our CMO saying that we needed to have a privacy policy for Sun Microsystems. Oh, and P.S., your boss, the CEO and chairman of the board, says there's zero privacy. And he followed up with the hearty get over it at a press conference. So you can imagine how much excited and enthusiastic senior level support we had back in the day. And so we just took it from there. And so I started out in the legal department and within 2 years left the legal department to set up the first chief privacy office. And you know, we did everything. We built a cloud. One of my titles there was Chief Governance Officer for Cloud, working for the CTO. We acquired the entire identity management portfolio that's still in operation today after we were purchased by Oracle. And I think that's part of my journey has been, I'm a lawyer by training, but I've taken many roles inside and outside of legal. I did sales for a year. I ran an analytics company for a year as its CEO. And currently I'm advising young companies and doing a startup in the privacy space, because part of the reason there's a couple reasons I rolled off as CEO. One is, you know, you find yourself 25 years into privacy and intellectual property, and suddenly privacy is the hot topic, and you're sort of sitting over there doing visualization analytics. And it's like, what am I doing over here when all the action is over there? So getting into privacy tech has been a real adventure and a pleasure. So I've sort of been all over the spectrum. And Ruby and I worked together again after they acquired McAfee. They did some due diligence, and bless his heart, long, long, long gone from that company. But the startup CEO at the time, or not really startup, they were like a 30-year-old startup. I interviewed with him and I said, sweetheart, why don't you have any sort of privacy program at all? And he said, oh, we don't have any data. What? And I mean, he's not alone, and it's 2020, y'all. But yeah, we had to fix a lot of things along the way. I think that's where I met Kay. I think it was my Intel McAfee days when we first met.
Yeah, we kind of passed each other quite frequently at conferences and all. But yeah, we actually really met for the first time at your Intel days.
Yeah. And of course, Hillary, I mean, we go back to conference board, and she's got a long storied career in science as well as privacy. So I think it shows you that the career path in privacy is absolutely as creative and broad or deep and specialized as you want it to be.
Yeah, I think our journeys show how often you have to recreate yourself. And the thing I like about that is it doesn't matter if you've practiced as long as Michelle has or someone who started a few years ago, you have to keep up. And so 20 years of experience is very helpful for other things, the soft skills, the leadership. But in terms of your competence in the field, you've got to keep up just as much as the guy who just started. Mm-hmm. And so it's very welcoming to everyone. People, you know, right out of college can do it. It's a field that's just going to keep growing. And so anyone can literally start and be welcome in it. And so that's what I also love about it.
Absolutely. Oh,
absolutely. I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. I just want to add to that, you know, it's interesting because if you've been doing this for a long time, and a long time in privacy is like 2 years. But if you've been doing it for a long time, I tell people routinely, and I'm not being humble in any sort of way, I'm not a privacy lawyer anymore, because it moves so quickly and it's so regional that you really have to rely on other specialists and keep your own humility in check, because your assumptions of how things were are not how they are today. And they certainly aren't going to be how they're going to be in 6 months' time even. So I think it's really important to recognize, A, it's a very welcoming field. We need a lot of specialization here. There's a lot of complexity here. But you certainly, it's not a place that you can just go and sit on your laurels in any sort of way.
I think I'll just jump in. First of all, I didn't realize you two had that history together. So that's fascinating.
I knew her when her baby was two weeks old.
I judged my relationship with Michelle on how old my youngest is, who's at University of Washington as a junior.
That's phenomenal. I haven't known either of you that long, but I feel like I've been in the privacy space forever. And I just want to agree so much that it is a space that, yeah, if you knew it well a long time ago, or even if you knew it well 5 years ago, it doesn't mean you know it well today, because it changes all the time. But I do agree also that it is so welcoming to so many different kinds of backgrounds. That's one of the things I love about it most. I think it's so multifaceted. I mean, you have the tech side, you have the legal side, you have the policy side, You have the creatives. I mean, like on our team, we actually have a creative person, an artist who helps us visualize privacy. And I really enjoy that so much. So one of the things that has been most fascinating to me about the current role at TrustArc is not just the GC side of what we do, but the work with the engineers. And I know both you, Ruby, and Michelle also work with engineers all the time. You know, even Michelle is an engineer, privacy engineer. And I think it's so important to understand how the law influences and the technology influences the law, or interpretation of the law and expectations of people, and being able to take your understanding of the way a law is written, or your understanding of people's expectations, and translate that into the way the technology is developed. To me, that's one of the most rewarding things. So going all the way back to the beginning of my career, when I had a chance to work as a scientist, it's been so fascinating to bring like the core elements of the discipline, the training as a scientist, into the work that I do today. I never thought I would get to do that again. I love being a scientist, and I feel like working with our engineers, our developers, I get to play in that space again. So it's really, I mean, it's like the best of everything working in privacy.
Well, and I love, Hillary's going to be humble and I'm not going to let her. She's also one of the leading lights in ethics. And I think that comes a lot of, you know, we talked, gosh, I think it was my last in-person meeting, Hillary, like millions of years ago, March, when we were talking about, you know, working with HeLa cells and thinking about human trials and ethics and subjects. There's a lot of adjacent history that deals with the very complex and incredibly human work that is the overlay of ethics and what should you build, not just what can you build, but what should you? And that overlays, you know, Ruby's dealing with how do people get essential medicines and get to their jobs and you know, locomotion around cities is part of our inherent family life. It's part of our commercial life. So none of the work that we do is divorced from humanity. And I think that's a really cool intersection as well.
Absolutely. If I had champagne, I'd say here, here. I can say them.
Cling.
Yes, okay, all virtually toasting each other. Love it. Love it. Well, it's just being able to listen to the three of you and soak in your experiences is very humbling for people in privacy. I mean, if this was an in-person panel and the three of y'all were just speaking about this, I mean, it'd be a packed room. We could probably host a live Zoom conference or something and people would probably flood the airwaves for it, because it's not just your backgrounds that you bring to it. It's your vision of the future. It's how ethically you think things should be done. It's understanding that perspectives are different around the world, which I love it when, Michelle, you said that, you know, they had no data. I hear that from salespeople at companies all the time. We don't need privacy. We don't have data. And I say, oh, how do you talk to anyone? How do you get a contract signed if you don't have any data?
How do you salaries?
So, yeah, you have no employees. You have no customers. You have no prospective customers. Then I guess you're right. You have no privacy.
Right, exactly. So it's, but the three of you especially understand how it is, where the blockers are for people. So what do you think is the biggest blocker globally for why we can't all land on the same page? Just with some basic structure, not just in the details, just basic structure. What's stopping us? And that might take us into the potential of a U.S. federal privacy law.
Well, given that we all have different lenses based on our own experiences, our culture, how we were raised, how we feel about technology, I have been working in the Silicon Valley or in tech, not necessarily in the Silicon Valley, even before I was a lawyer, as after my undergrad job. So you would be surprised to know I have a data moat around my home. I don't have any more smart devices than I need. I mean, I'm an early adopter of something super functional and great. Like I was an early adopter of an iPod, for example, and I have obviously a nice smartphone, but I have no personal assistant in my home. It took me forever to upgrade to a smart TV. I don't want anything smart. I have dumb cars. I have a dumb fridge. I have a dumb toaster. And so it's surprising to people that I'm a Luddite when it comes to adopting things where I feel I don't trust where the data is going, and I don't, you know, I don't see the trade-off, right? The proportionality doesn't work for me. And so if I'm like that, imagine if you multiplied me, you know, millions of times around the world and people's personal viewpoint of what privacy means. And so it's so personal. I mean, like, I have pants right on right now, right? That's private. I don't know what Michelle's got on.
It's a dress. I have a dress.
She like, don't ask, don't tell.
Very different than me, right? Okay. So we all come with these viewpoints. And, you know, based on how I was raised and the country I live in and the state I live in and how I deal with technology, and it's just never going to land on the same spot for everybody. Mm. You are never going to please everybody. And that's why we advocate for privacy features to be default on, because that way you can make the choice. And if you're a person who likes the trade-off, and you know, you want to engage in the benefits that come with turning that feature back on, then go ahead. But we don't want people making all these decisions for us. I don't want the curtains ripped from my window because that's what somebody else thinks is appropriate privacy. So I don't see us ever landing in the same spot on it. And personally, I don't think it's ever, you know, going to get better, because right now, I feel like it's, I don't know what airport it is. It might have been Frankfurt. But you know how you see those horror movies, or you have a dream where you're running down the hall and it keeps elongating and you never get to the end of it? That's the way that day was. And I was late for my flight, and every corner I turned was another long hallway. And I'm like, no, that's the way privacy is evolving. It's not maturing because the technology is not stopping. We keep coming up with new things that bring a privacy issue to the forefront. We got to figure out what it is, how we use it, what are the benefits. And so that hallway just keeps going and going and going. And there is never going to be a stopping point where we all land. We all have time to get used to it. We all make our decisions and everything is stable. That's just not the way it is. And then, of course, the laws right now are not harmonized and all the other accoutrement that comes around privacy. So that's my own opinion anyhow.
Michelle?
Yeah, I think I share all of those opinions. I think it's really interesting. It's sort of like we've accepted that we're going to feed 7 billion plus human beings on the planet with a limited amount of sort of, you know, you can be a vegetarian, you can be an omnivore, you know, whatever. But somehow, and we say that it is possible to have food that is of a high enough quality that's not going to kill people, right? We have standards around what is acceptable food, and we allow people to choose. I mean, if we were fully regulated, why would anyone be legally allowed to eat Doritos? They're not really food, right? But they're snacky and they're tasty. But, you know, we sort of feel like if we can't regulate every dot of privacy, then privacy is over and it doesn't exist, or privacy is dead, or some version of that. You know, we can't exist, or we can't have advertising without surveillance. And it's all bunk. And the reality is that when we approach the problem of privacy as not a problem, but a condition, and this is where I've been talking a lot lately about wicked privacy, which is my version of there's a certain set of problems that are defined as wicked problems. And a wicked problem is something that is never solved. You're never done. When you solve one piece of a wicked problem, you pop out another one. So think about poverty or climate change. Think about privacy as a wicked problem where, for example, you want things to be quite secure. So that requires some cost. So maybe you're going to use a little encryption. Okay, well, then maybe the man in the middle can't see it. That means you're going to have to manage the keys. Okay, well, where are we going to store those keys? Well, that's a new problem. Oh, now we've got authentication. So we're gathering more data. And so it goes. And so if you view that as an insurmountable problem, then you sort of just play catch up and you hope to God that you're not going to get a fine or stop doing what you're doing. If instead you get on top of that and you say, okay, how would we take a multi-stakeholder approach, as Hillary said, and Ruby too, having a diverse team, having different perspectives on what is the user interface that an artist can make more accessible and easier to use? And you can tell whether you're eating Doritos or asparagus by the label or by the visual. these are the types of innovations, I think, that have to evolve as we figure out, not as a society, but as a group of societies and cultures that will never have one consistent language of privacy, if you will. But somehow we have to figure out how to translate. How do we have signs so that when you are, and it probably was Frankfurt, Ruby, because I've been there, and everything's gray, so you can't really tell where you are or how much progress you've made.
And it's terribly big.
It's huge, and you're running.
I have no sense of direction, too.
Ruby. So Ruby and I used to work in a square building, and I'd be like, Ruby, it's like one right turn. She's like, what?
That's right. I will say, though, Michelle, and Paul already picked up on this, too, more than likely, wicked privacy is going to make its way into the title of this episode.
I hope so. I'm offering a wicked workshop, so I would love to help you do that. I'm not even joking. I'm working with this wonderful retired lieutenant colonel. His name's Brian Lee. And the reason I got stuck in this problem is, you know, he said to me, this is a wicked problem that you're explaining to me. And I said, what do you mean? He said he spent 20 years doing anti-nuclear proliferation. And, you know, the only thing that he can tell me about his work in the Army was that the world did not blow up. And it took a lot more doing than you think. And it took, like we were very close to the brink on many different occasions, as you can imagine. And it takes a lot of different perspectives to solve a problem. And that's just on the strategic level. So that's the, what is the strategery? And it goes into the other part of this issue is, A, I think we're underregulated and we're poorly regulated, trying to get things like do not sell. That's like starting in the middle and saying, you know, the center of my Oreo cookie isn't tasty enough. I'm like, what? Instead of saying, hey, let's take a comprehensive view or have some damn metrics. Oh, is that a technical word for podcasting? Some darn metrics. Yeah, metrics is probably a dirtier word than any of the George Carlin ones. But having decent metrics at boards, like public boards, think about how many breaches and how much harm has gone down. Cambridge Analytica on a political harm side, tons and tons of time, productivity, insurance records that have been botched. I mean, real human need, not just $50 lost off of your credit card being stolen. And yet, how many chief privacy officers or privacy professionals are sitting on public boards, not to waggle a finger, but to say, are we strategically managing to avoid a breach, or are we strategically managing so that the people, our communities, our employees are being managed in a positive way from a monetary perspective, but also a community and a sustainability positive way so that all of this data is actually working for us and we're not working for the machines?
Well, I think it's still the confusion over data security being data privacy.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
It's secure. Whew. I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's still a thing, surprisingly, but we're so steeped in it that it's hard for us to imagine someone still thinking like that, but they do.
Just ticking a few boxes and thinking that they are done.
I think we're just regulating the space wrong. I think that everything about how it's been approached to date is causing people to think about checking boxes. And I think if we found a different way to regulate that actually caused businesses to understand the value in the data that they have and to continue to have incentive to have a license to use that data, perhaps we'd have different type of business decision making. But I don't think, going back to what both of you mentioned earlier, I don't think people even think about their data. They think about the data from a, yes, I want to make data-driven decisions, and some businesses do, but a lot of businesses don't. And they, you know, completely bifurcate the role of data in the business from the privacy compliance or the security so we don't have a breach. But they don't think about these things holistically. And I've over the years suggested that a more aligning privacy, which I think you both do really well, to data-driven decisions within organizations is really the way that we can get to better outcomes, where it's not about checking boxes, but it's about driving better outcomes and better engagements with people who are our customers and who we want to be our customers. The other thing I'll say, just in terms of like why we can't
think about it the way that we have historically is that so much, as Ruby said already, it's about people and how they view the world. And whether you're living next door to each other and you were raised by different people and you have different values, we don't all see things the same. It's why some people wear masks and other people refuse. And Paul has his wish of everyone to wear one. I mean, people see the world differently. And no matter, I would say as I've gotten older, and I feel very old these days, the thing that astounds me the most versus how I was raised is that there's just such broad disparity in how people view themselves and the world around them. And I think that's part of what makes the world so fascinating is the diversity of views. And I think going back to what we're talking about with respect to privacy teams, having more people on the privacy teams who see things differently, different training, different backgrounds that can help bring to bear when you make decisions about data and you make decisions about the tech that people engage with, recognizing that no matter what, not everybody's going to like it. They're going to see it differently. And so how, to Ruby's point, do you default to privacy settings and allow people, if they're like, yeah, I don't care, I want do whatever you want with my data. Mm-hmm. That's their choice to decide you to let you do that. But we shouldn't assume that people are okay with that. So because of that, I think it's really hard to regulate. I think more though, if we can help drive regulation to facilitate better data use and better data value and better outcomes for the world as to how we use data, that we will get to a much better place than where we are today.
Yep. Yeah, that touches on a couple of topics that we, a couple of episodes we've had on social justice and how we really need to welcome diversity and be very inclusive in our efforts because there are so many different perspectives. We can't possibly guess what they all are. We need the people themselves to inform us what those perspectives are. I love it.
Yeah.
So Ruby, do you see lots of differences around the world with people using the Uber apps and whether they make requests, whether they want certain functionality, yes or no, whether they want to share certain data, yes or no? Is that indeed truly impacted by cultural differences or is it just the legislation?
No, it's definitely impacted by cultural differences. In some countries, for example, we allow women to pick women writers, not everywhere. But it's very important to their desire and ability to get a ride. In other countries, we have significant safety issues. And so we may have dash cams being a very welcome development. And frankly, to be completely frank, if I were in one of those countries, I would want a dash cam too. So, but you know, if I'm here in the San Francisco Bay Area, I don't feel like I need a dash cam. So there are a lot of variants around the world based on the environment, the safety issues, safety, you know, and privacy is a real struggle for us. We were the first company to publish a very blunt safety report because we feel like you need transparency into these things to fix them. And we certainly can't fix this problem, which is across, you know, many industries alone. But those things are very difficult because both, you know, privacy concerns and the safety concerns are so important. So there's a lot that goes into the analysis on, you know, how you derive people's preferences. And it does vary a lot, you know.
Interesting. And Michelle, I, in my introduction, I already said, I know you as the godmother of privacy engineering. from all the IAPP conferences, Michelle, that is linked to privacy engineering. Why? How? Yeah, what is the question here? How did that happen?
What's wrong with you, woman?
No, certainly not, because I do think it's inspiring. But how did you come up with the, how did it land in your lap? How did you think of it? Why do we have something like privacy engineering now next to all the privacy lawyers?
Yeah, so sadly, I mean, so I'll start with, I'm not actually even an engineer. I have a BS degree in psychology and I have a law degree. But I was raised in a broken home where my dad was a computer scientist before that was a title. I think his undergraduate degree is mathematics, but they didn't have something called computer science at the time because there were really just sort of UNIVAC back then. But, you know, from the time even before he graduated from The Ohio State University, he was already working as a civilian for the Navy, working in their compute
division. And then during the Vietnam War, he enlisted and worked for the Navy doing, you know, large scale computing. So I always kind of joke that I was raised on a raised floor. Now he did go to night school on the GI Bill, as did my mother. And so both of them were intellectual property lawyers as well. But Dad always worked as a systems and security engineer. He installed the first firewall at Corning Glass. He put together the identity management system for United Airlines and for the Mayo Clinic and on and on. So part of, you know, my weekly ritual was calling home, you know, like bring, you know, talk about your cultural and your business lives coming together. And as we were doing things, you know, way back in the day, like acquiring a company called Gridware. Remember that one, Ruby? It was a long time ago, back when we called what we call now the cloud, the grid. It was a utility grid and it was a German company that we bought, and it had not just implications, but it was seated in the 95 directive of this had a lot of just, quote unquote, just industrial data. It allowed people to connect systems and sort of take that model of remote compute that we all started on. Well, I shouldn't say we all, because now everybody's young, but When you started learning about a computer back in the late 70s, early 80s, like I did, everything was timeshare. So if you took a compute class in the 1980s, there were personal computers in the marketplace, but most of the time you went to the computer lab and you had time that you literally had to share on a group computer, and that's how you learned how to code and operate. And that
my high school had one computer.
Yeah. And that, you know, and we're not that old. And so part of, you know, the long-winded question was this mix of, as a patent litigator and then an early privacy practitioner, I would always call home and talk to my dad about, you know, what are the strategies? What are the protective measures? How would I ensure that data could be limited? And at the same time, I was working for Sun Microsystems, and, you know, we call them Kubernetes and Docker and things now. It's so cute. They're containers, they're virtual machines, they're hypervisors that are connecting timeshare / cloud instances together. So as you think about all of that, I was like, why can't I get to the developer and say to the developer, I want something that is privacy by design, because Ann Cavoukian had come up with her seven principles. And I'd go to technical conferences and I'd say, okay, the default setting for privacy is X. And they were like, I don't even know what that means. Okay, let's make this user-centric. I don't even know what that means. And so what we had to do is take what are the core, I call them the dirty dozen. There's like 12 basic privacy principles that are at the heart of every single piece of legislation in the world. You know, things like choice and consent, proportionality, data minimization, security, all this kind of stuff. And then you have to layer on the cultural differences between sharing data across jurisdictional boundaries, some of which are completely arbitrary, like going from Rhode Island into Boston, unless there was a sign, you would not know, but there are different laws. So all of that said, we took this approach and sat down and Dad and I sort of hashed things out. And then along the way, working with people like Ruby, working with Jonathan Fox, who was an early pioneer in online licensing protocols, and then was the editor-in-chief of Sun.com, which was our website at the time. We said, what's the business approach? What's the operational approach? What is the potential known engineering principles and strategies, universal modeling language? And so we put that together into what we started to call privacy engineering, and very quickly realized, and this was actually Richard Purcell that changed the title and sort of was the light bulb over my head, that what we ended up writing was the Privacy Engineer's Manifesto, because it's not an engineering textbook, you know, to the extent that I'm constantly get emails from hither and yon saying this is not a technical how-to book. And I say, that's adorable. That's a whole PhD course. And you can talk to other people about that.
Yeah, learn all of privacy engineering in a book?
Yeah, what? You know, 400 pages, just read it. It's all fine.
You learn every other type of engineering in a simple
Yeah, like networking. I mean, you can get that, identity management, you can do that, like all of it. So it's kind of, but I think that's where, and it's certainly like, and even in the manifesto, and Ruby helped us on that book as well. And I think Hillary, we talked about stuff. There's tons and tons of contributors. And the purpose of it was to be sort of like recombinant DNA. So you could pick up the first third if you're a policy person and sort of think about how people were thinking about it. And you can see the GDPR was in draft at that point. You can pick up the center section and go to things like UML. Go to things like whether you're doing a waterfall or an agile implementation. There's a language of project management and a whole fleet, a whole world of product managers that know what a clean desk looks like for software, for hardware, for implementation. And then the final part of the methodology is how do we seed it in business? How do you build a program that actually helps you walk the walk and not just talk the talk? And then how do you come up with a number of different ways of assigning value? Because you can avoid risk for GDPR for a couple of years, but you're not going to have a sustainable budget to actually respect the data of your customers' employees over time unless you're somehow tying that value back to the flow of information, how it's feeding your business and delighting your customers' employees.
So Ruby, would you say you're a privacy engineer as well, having heard this?
No, I would not. My background, I have a management science degree, which is a logic-based function, but not necessarily as technical. That said, I couldn't work in the technical field as long as I have without being technically astute and able to understand how technical things work, not to the extent of an engineer would by any means, but you have to have a basic understanding of those things, which goes back to our point of this horizontal function where you're working with so many different people across the board. You know, I work with the engineers, I work with the product people, I work with the comms people, the PR people, we have privacy champions in the business units. You know, it's just this massive group of people. And so you have to be able, data scientists, we have a wonderful one. So you have to be able to speak other people's language, and you have to have a grounding enough and an interest enough, which is really all it takes, to be honest, an interest enough to learn how to translate each other's functions. So I don't expect them to be a lawyer, right? I don't know a single privacy engineer that says I'm also a privacy lawyer. You know, if they're in the function of the engineering, they typically do not have a law degree. In fact, I don't think I've actually met an engineer who has a law degree. I'm sure there's some out there, but you usually choose one or the other. And so, you know, you just have to know enough to be able to converse appropriately so you can help each other. And you have to have, in any function, enough soft skills to collaborate well across this broad variety of backgrounds, you know, religions, creeds, colors, genders, specialties, you know, feelings, everything that makes up a human being so that you can come up with the best solutions. I think that's one of the things lost in a lot of when people talk about what it takes to be a privacy professional of any sort is the soft skills. You can't do this alone and do a good job. You got to work with a bunch of other people to do the job. So you better learn how to get along with all kinds of different people.
Translator. Ultimately, the privacy leader is a translator across many different languages, enabling them all to work together.
I think the humor language is Michelle. Why we get invited to the party?
It's true. We're never not memorable. People may be annoyed with what we've said, or we may make people slightly uncomfortable sometimes because humor's tough, but it's memorable. And a lot of, it's interesting because, you know, there's always the critic, you know, there's always the heckler who's not brave enough to stand on stage themselves, but they'll be like, oh, that thing you said. But if you can catch somebody's ear, even if they're a little bit like burr in the saddle, and they can start to like, I have been the burr in many saddles. But never in disrespect. I mean, I think this is the other thing is like, you know, I can be outrageous and stuff, and I have been, but I don't call people names. I don't disparage other groups. I'm very frank about what's going on. Like, I'm not going to say there's not, you know, a serious racial problem here going on. And it, and of course it, it, and the reason I'm so forward facing with that kind of stuff is I think it's interesting. I think there's sort of this one side that's sort of, I'll say politically correct, but I don't even know what that means anymore, that says, let's just be very careful to not offend vulnerable populations or whoever feels vulnerable at the time, which could be a very dominant population. And sort of like, that's professional. I think the other side of this is, for example, let's take race in America right now. And it's not just America. You know, for any of your listeners, I know it's going on everywhere in human world. But if you say, let's make sure that we are protecting the Black community, none of the people on this phone call are Black. One of the things that's been tough is getting enough people of color and particularly women of color into the cybersecurity and privacy realm is they have to take advantage of social media. They have to put themselves out there because within the current community, there's just not enough see it, then be it. We will build that momentum. But so by using social media and putting a spotlight on themselves, they put themselves at risk in many cases because they're unusual and that the unusual ones are where the herd typically attacks, but they also, it's a lifeline to them. So it's never just, let's clamp this down. Let's make sure we're not talking about it. In fact, I am a believer in the reason we have a First Amendment in the US, which is I think sunlight is a very good disinfectant. And sometimes you have to sort of make light of things a little bit so that we'll talk about uncomfortable things and realize, like, of the last 10 people that you talked to, have you talked to anyone who was raised in poverty? Have you talked to someone of a different religion? Have you talked to someone of a different color of the last 10 people you spoke to? If not, it doesn't make you a racist, but it may mean that you should widen your circle when you're looking at specs that can have impact over 7 billion humans that you're building a bridge for. Just saying.
Yeah, and it's so much more important now with COVID to just, like, I can't tell you how much time I spend on people now. I mean, I've had one-on-ones with my staff and dropped in one-on-ones and stuff for a long time, but well-being is my job one right now. Mm-hmm. Well-being of the team. And that means all those things Michelle just said, you have to just be a good listener. You have to accept people's challenges without judgment. You know, because COVID is impacting people of color more. It's impacting women more. And God bless you if you're a woman person of color. And so the challenges that people are having can be very different than your own. And you have to look at what a workload means for somebody differently, what a successful employee means differently, quality over quantity. You know, there are very specific and practical things that leaders should be doing right now to keep their team retained and motivated that go beyond talking about the problem. I am talking about things you actually do every day, every week. And that's what my focus has been. And I think I'm developing new habits that I will now just continue infinity. And so it's the silver lining of COVID that, you know, if you're not a good people manager right now, good luck with that.
Better learn real fast.
Yeah, exactly.
I think this has caused many people who have felt that empathy is a really important part of even how you think about privacy, but how you manage people. It's brought it to the forefront because people are, Ruby, to your point, people are struggling and people struggle in different ways. And far be it from any one of us to assume that we really know what it's like to feel like that person who's on the other side of the video camera feels. And it's just more important than ever that we have the empathy for others and try to feel where they are and support them regardless, because at least for all of our lifetime, this is unprecedented.
Right.
And if we get through this, hopefully it creates much greater opportunities on the other side.
I hope so too. I mean, I you know what I really love, and I love that Ruby touched on it, which is I hope that there's some learning that we've done in this last sort of 2020. You know, it was supposed to be the great century of women's suffrage in the US. And what it really has been is like a 2020 eye-opening of like, all of the weaknesses and what could possibly go wrong.
All at one time. The bingo card joke has just exploded.
All
I know there was
one.
One thing that came out and I was like, bingo, we're done. No, we're not.
Yeah, like aliens are going to start attacking us and what. But I think the good thing to learn about this is A, this, how do you have this integrated leader? How do you have someone who can touch on, you know, hardcore business numbers and soft skills and manage well? And the reality is that I'm hoping what we've all learned is no one person is that paragon. We have to rely on each other. And I think the other part that I love is I love that it's completely normal for kids to walk in and ask about homework and dogs to come loping in, and it's perfectly fine. Like, at what point in our society during, you know, rabid industrialization do we stop being human beings? And I think that's the part that I love the most is like people are like, oh, I'm so sorry, that's my dog. And I'm like, what's your dog's name? And, you know, it's good.
You mean good. Like my cat, Charlie, that's been walking around through most of our show?
I am loving Charlie so hard. I know Ruby's cat and cats in the past, rest in peace. And it's a part of who we are as people.
Exactly. And that is a fantastic note to end on. Paul, would you like to bring us to a close?
Of course. Well, then I tell everybody, first of all, to all ladies on this show, thank you very much for being with us today. And to all our listeners, if you like our series, thank you for continuing to listen. We are really excited about the number of downloads that we see for every single episode. But please continue to tell your friends and colleagues about us. Subscribe in your favorite podcast application. Rate and review us whenever you can. And should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as EuroPaulB. Thank you again for listening to this episode of Serious Privacy, and until our next episode, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.